At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
It's the Son of a Butch podcast. We come to you every Wednesday. Happy New Year. Took a couple weeks off. Hope everyone had a happy and safe holiday season. Got a little cold weather here in Florida for Christmas, which was nice. But I hope everybody had fun. So the pod is back. And this week, Gil Hantz, probably the hardest architect in golf architecture, certainly from a major championship standpoint. I mean, Gil seems to be that guy right now that all the governing bodies, specifically the U.S. Open, they seem to be choosing Gil to come in and do a lot of the redesigns. We talk about that. He did a redesign of the Wingfoot course that Bryson DeChambeau won the U.S. Open on, redesign of the U.S. Open course, the Country Club that Matt Fitzpatrick won on last year, and Los Angeles Country Club redid that one, and that's where the U.S. Open will be held this year. I love his work. I like him as a person. I think he's a really, really cool guy. I like the aesthetic. And listen, golf architecture is a hot topic, right? From an aesthetic standpoint, from a distance standpoint, from a design standpoint. And Gil is definitely at the forefront of golf course architecture in 2022. So sit back and enjoy the interview with Gil Hantz. Well, Gil, thanks for taking the time to do this. I've had golf instructors, I've had professional golfers, but to get a golf course architect like yourself, that's a huge thing. And I'm super excited to talk to you. Full disclosure, when I was younger, my dad was building South Shore Harbor in Clear Lake, Texas for Bruce Devlin and Von Agee. And I worked in the summertime on helping him build the golf course.
So you know what it's like. The only way to do it. Get your hands dirty.
It is amazing, you know, when you look at what golf courses become. I mean, that experience has always kind of shaped my view of it. You know, we were, you know, putting in the drains and the bunkers and then filling it up with the gravel. And, you know, they were still grading the lake parts. And then they were shaping the greens. When you see a golf course from start to finish, it is an amazing process. And it's something that I think for someone like you to get to do that on a regular basis, it must just be an amazing experience.
It is. And first and foremost, it's fun. I mean, to see, you know, you see probably, you know, with what you do, you see a progression. I mean, maybe you're that good that you see instant results, but you work with a student and you see the progression over time. And from us, it's like a daily thing. You can, at the end of the day, I've said this before, my favorite time on site is when we shut the machines off and we get out of them and we look at what we've accomplished that day. And you can see what you've shaped. You can see the creation, all of these things. And I think that's, number one, it's rewarding because it's quiet. You're finally out of the machine. And number two, the sun's usually going down. And so it's just that special, special time on site. But having the ability to see a daily result over and over again, and then, you know, shifting landscapes, different projects, et cetera, is one of the more rewarding parts of what we get to do.
Why golf instruction for you, Gil? I mean, talk me through, you know, what made you get into this, why you did it, and how you started.
Yeah, it's I came to golf, you know, later, like I was 16. I think my grandfather was the only golfer in our family. And he hung the moon as far as I was concerned. I idolized him. I've never met a nicer man. And just the way he handled himself, it was a great role model. And when he invited me to go play golf, it was like, yes. And I think I fell in love with the golf landscape then. I'm not sure if it was because he was in that golf landscape or whether it was just the beauty of it. I'd never seen anything like that or experienced it. And then it got to be a point where I just, you know, over time went along and, you know, went to school, studied political science and history, which, you know, was where I thought I was going to go with my life.
I had the exact same major, by the way.
Did you really?
We're both in the golf industry.
So, you know, yeah, exactly. You know exactly. It's like, okay, now what do you do when you have that? So I wound up going to Cornell and studying city and regional planning and not landscape architecture. And I met a guy named Tom Griswold, who subsequently went on to work for Tom Fazio for years and years. He was studying to be a golf architect. And I went home. Tracy and I were engaged at the time. We've been married now for 36 years. I went home and said, listen, you can do this. You can actually become a golf architect. I doodled holes for forever. And it was going to mean another year of school because I didn't have a design undergrad, but she was incredibly supportive and switched gears right then and there. So it was not a linear path by any stretch of the imagination. But come to say, and I'm sure it helps you as well, you know, the history of the game, understanding, appreciating it, you know, if through your eyes, the evolution of the golf swing and the equipment and technology, through our eyes, the evolution of golf courses, and especially when we deal with a lot of these great old clubs, that's an important part of it. And you know as well, club politics are brutal. So having an understanding of, you know, sort of the political science, how you deal with people, how you handle people. So while it wasn't a direct benefit to me, it's that degree combination has paid off over the years.
You said that you did a lot of drawings and stuff like that. I mean, I think, you know, I'm 53, you know, we're certainly not young people. And I think now you can go online and look at all of the great golf courses. There's videos. There's so much content. There's so much information out there. But when I was growing up, my dad had all these great old books, and there were the top 100 golf courses in the world. You know, it was a book probably in the 70s. And I remember just looking through it, and it had, you know, pictures of the holes. And then it had like a little aerial map of what the layout was. And I used to go on, take, you know, magic markers and, you know, draw all these, you know, fancy holes and try and make golf courses. And my dad was like, you have no idea what the hell you're doing. That's never going to work. But I just love the drawing and the over. I remember we lived in Morocco and my dad was the first golf pro at Royal Dar Salaam, Trent Jones. They had 54 holes there. And they had, I mean, we moved there in the 70s and they had this, like, it's like a, I guess it was a model of the golf course that, you know, that actually, you know, those old ones from the 70s, yeah. It was actually a real, it was big. It was really big and it was covered in like a dome case and everything. And I just always remember being fascinated by that. And then after the Ryder Cup in Paris, I went back to Royal Dar Salaam for the first time. I hadn't been back to Morocco since the 70s. And it was still there. It was still, I mean, you know, it was like the little, you know, the little tiny flags, yeah, with, like pins and stuff. So I was always fascinated with it. I read a quote that you said that your job is to identify which of the property's natural elements you want to emphasize. So when you go and you look at a site, do you think in 2022, Gil, we're getting, for new build golf courses, we're getting more, for you guys, more interesting sites than we have in the past? Because if you look at where great golf courses historically are being, you know, built, the old school ones, they're in urban areas, right? You know, if you look at, you know, Wingfoot, LA Country Club, Southern, these are in urban areas. And I think so many of the great, great new build design golf courses are going to some amazing locations. Why do you think there is that push to do that now?
I think we went through a period of time in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s where golf development and design, with a few exceptions, obviously, were predicated on golf as an amenity, right? It was there to sell lots. It was there to feature a housing development, or there were, you know, golf wasn't the primary focus. And then we went through a really steep decline in golf construction and new golf courses starting in the early 2000s. And running for a period of time where nobody was building golf courses. The only ones who were doing it were the visionaries. You had Dick Young's cap at Sand Hills a little prior to that. Then Mike Kaiser came along. Then Rich Mack at Stream Song. And so you had people who were willing to embrace the vision of quality golf will attract people to go anywhere, right? Yeah. And you're literally in the middle of nowhere in a lot of these things. You know, and we had the great fortune of Michael Walrath doing the same thing at a Hoopie Match Club. So you had people whose primary focus was golf first and foremost. And with the concept of, you know, Field of Dreams, build it and they will come. the thing that you pointed out, which was interesting, and it was nowhere near as remote, but back in the day, you know, LACC, Winged Foot, Southern Hills, they were outside the city. I mean, it was a long, it took people a long time to get there. So they were considered remote as it related to the modes of transportation at the time.
You know, my dad talks about that when he comes down to Seminole, because, you know, my grandfather was the head bro there for forever, and he grew up there. So where when you go into Seminole on the left-hand side, the maintenance barn, the house that's there, my dad says, listen, that's where we used to live. And he said, you know, when we came here in the, you know, in the 40s and the 50s, this was just all sand dunes. There was nothing here. So it's actually, the golf courses like Winged Foot, they were outside of the city, but now when you go out there, they're so penned in. And one of the things that I think that's interesting that you mentioned, I never thought of that, but a lot of the great, you know, the old school golf courses that they would want to have major championships at in 2022, there just isn't the land and the infrastructure for everything that it would take to have a major championship there. But you're right. I mean, Southern Hills, we were just there for the PGA. That would have been way outside of the city back in the day, but you don't think that way. That's a really interesting thought. You mentioned Southern Hills. They just had the PGA there in 2022. I was there. Oh gosh, it's got to be 01 was the last time I was there for the U.S. Open that Retief Goosen won. Gil, that golf course is unrecognizable from what it was 20 years ago. I mean, I got there and I was like, I couldn't remember any of the holes because the golf course looks so much different. The task when you're being tasked. I mean, if you look at last year, the major championships, the Country Club, you guys did work on that. Southern Hills, you did work on that. LA Country Club, where the US Open is in 2023, you've done work there. Winged Foot. When you get the call to do something like this, is it that call that a golden era golf course gives you guys the call? Is it excitement? Is it wonderment? Is it, what's the feeling when you get the call and you know you're going to get it? I mean, to get an opportunity to go to a place like the Country Club, you know, that's, you know, 1800s, Winged Foot, all the history there. How much of it is excitement, trepidation, responsibility that you feel that you've been given this huge task to basically take a master work of art and now change it?
It's all of the above. I mean, all of the emotions that you mentioned. I'm still at heart the biggest golf geek nerd when it comes to golf courses. I mean, when I drive into the Country Club, I still wave to the cardboard cutout that's sitting in the, you know, the guard shack. And it's just these little things that you have these pinch me moments of, wow, you know, they're trusting us with this, as you said, work of art, this masterpiece. And I think, you know, the way Jim Wagner and I have always approached these things is with the ultimate amount of respect for the original architect and trying to do the best we can. And back to my history degree, trying to really delve into what did they do here? What did Perry Maxwell do at Southern Hills? I don't care what Perry Maxwell did in Oklahoma City or at Colonial. It doesn't really matter. I don't care what Tillinghast did at San Francisco Golf Club. What matters is what did he do at Winged Foot, and on and on. And I think that level of precision, and trust me, we are so lucky that we work at these great places that they have great archives. So we can go back and look at aerial photographs of every shot sequence of Bobby Jones when he won the 1929 U.S. Open at Winged Foot. You know, those don't exist at some other places. And so you do the homework, you do the best that you possibly can. When we found the 1929 U.S. Women's Amateur Program at Oakland Hills that had photos of every single green complex taken from the fairway, it was like the gold mine, because now we could literally stand in the same place and look at that and try to recreate it. So it's a similar formula, whether it's Oakmont or whether it's Winged Foot or whether it's, you know, the Creek Club or Sleepy Hollow or some of these great old courses that are never going to host major championships. Yet still we focus as much as we possibly can on getting all those details right and figuring it out. And then the other part of it is that we've got to trust that what Perry Maxwell did at Southern Hills in 1936 is still relevant to challenge somebody like Justin Thomas in 2022 and to test the best players. And the answer is yes. And I think that's one of the things that served Jim and I the best is that we've, granted, we have to add back tees, we have to shift bunkers, we have to do things to accommodate the distance that they play. But at the core of the golf course, the strategy and the interest, and as you said earlier, finding the best natural features, these guys did all of that. And so we have to check our ego at the door and think, hey, we're not going to improve on Tillinghast. We're just going to restore what he did and try and get the picture as close to, you know, the image that was there when he first built the golf course. And if we can do those things, we just have to trust that that's going to be good enough. And you know this, preparing players for major championships, we can do everything we want and need to with the course. The USGA, the PGA can do everything they need or want with the setup, but it's all going to come down to the weather that week. You know, if it rains, the golf course is going to play one way. If it's bone dry, it's going to play another way. The crazy thing about Southern Hills is we had like all four seasons in one week. So those guys, they had every single possible test, which was great. And I think that added tremendously to the championship. So I think it's learning several things that we've come to accept. And for a while, when we first started doing this, it was hard to accept is that, hey, once the week of the championship starts, our hands are off the wheel. We've got nothing to do with it. And two is just to accept that Tillinghast, Ross, McKenzie, those guys were so good at what they did that we just have to trust that their architecture is going to be good in this era as well.
So let's take a quick break to thank our partner Four Wellness. You guys have heard me talk about it. I'm a big fan of their coffee, big fan of the good stuff. I put it in my coffee on a regular basis. The thing I like about it, no sugars, no artificial sweeteners. It's gotten me off dairy. I've quit putting sweeteners, sugars in, just the good stuff. Put a scoop of that in my coffee, but I also put it in smoothies and take it on the road with me. And the other thing that I've been using are their energy bites. I keep them with me on the golf course. A lot of times when I'm out on tour, I don't have a lot of time to sit and eat. So these energy bites, a little coffee hit, a little bit of energy, all the good stuff, all natural. And if you haven't given those a try, check those out. They've given me a special code to share with Son of a Butch listeners. You can get 20% off your order, plus free shipping and a free starter kit worth $30 for a limited time when you visit forwellness.com/podcast. That's spelled forwellness.com/podcast. And enter the code CH3 at checkout. It's their best offer right now, so give it a try. They even back every purchase with a 60-day money-back guaranteed. That's, again, the code CH3 at forwellness.com/podcast. So now let's get back to the interview.
I read that in doing some of the work you did at the Country Club at Brookline, you looked at images, as you said, about Oakland Hills from 1934. You were able to kind of look at the golf course and what it was. Gil, why do you think, so if you look at what you are being tasked to do with a lot of these great old school golden era golf courses, why do you think they have changed so much and you're taking it back to what it was? Why couldn't they stay the way they were? Because a lot of times we see golf courses now that we go back to that you guys come into and all the designers come in, and they there's this push to take it back to the original design, what the original designer wanted. Why do you think golf courses evolve and change to where you're trying to take them back? Is it just evolution? Is it just what happens with trees and earth and dirt that over 50, 60, 70, 80 years, everything changes?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to contemplate that somebody would ever put aluminum siding on a Frank Lloyd Wright house, but that happened. You know, people look at technology and what's new and what's, and you also have to think that back in the day, Donald Ross, Tillinghast, they weren't gods. They were just guys. And there were competitors of theirs, younger men, who came along in the generation after them, who didn't have this reverence for their work. And they were more than happy to put their fingerprints all over it and change it in the basically under the guise of, hey, we're modernizing. because the game has changed so much. We've gone from hickory shafts to steel shafts. We've changed golf balls, et cetera. You know, not unlike what happens, you know, just the history of golf and the reaction that golf courses have doesn't change. I mean, that's been, it was happening in the 20s, 30s, 40s. And so those guys were not reticent at all to move a green, blow up a green, do this, do that. And so I think you had this period of time where, and you also had heavy earth moving equipment come into the construction process. You know, it wasn't mules and scrapers moving a green. It was a bulldozer and excavator and just push it over there and go ahead and do it. So I think it was a combination of all those factors. The other thing that really added dramatically to it was irrigation. You know, when these guys built golf courses, you didn't have wall-to-wall irrigation. You didn't have the ability to go ahead. And so what happens over time is when the first irrigation systems went in, they weren't five row, they weren't three row, they were one row irrigation system. So that went down the center. Now, all of a sudden, you've got this big open golf course with one row of irrigation down the center, and you've got this green swath and all this brown around it. Well, that doesn't look great. So what do? Well, we fill the space with trees. We start putting trees in where the irrigation doesn't get. And now all of a sudden the trees start to grow in and we start to change and alter the look of the landscape. And well, what do trees do? They grow. So eventually the trees grow, they fill the space. The golf course becomes narrower just through that type of evolution. So you have a combination of all these steps and that's where you get to. And then you don't get until maybe the late 80s when Frank Hannigan writes his piece on A.W. Tillinghast. And it's called The Forgotten Genius. In the USGA Golf Journal. And then the next thing you know, there's a Don Ross Society. And there is this appreciation for great golf course architecture. And these golf architects become cult figures. And then it becomes, as you mentioned earlier, part of the internet. And you can go on and you can Google and you can learn. And now there's a Rainer Society, a McKenzie Society. And so this evolution gets us to where we are now, where, you know, it's on the back of every scorecard, a Seth Rainer design, A.W. Tillinghast, and the clubs have appreciation. And thankfully, you know, there's a generation of golf course architects who also recognize that, hey, what they did was pretty special. Let's go back. So I think that's kind of the timeline of where we got to where we are. And we're really happy that we've been entrusted to what we think is do the right thing by putting that stuff back.
When we look at the great golf courses, you know, I went through and I saw that you listed your, this was in 2020, but you listed your top 10 golf courses in the world, St. Andrews, National Golf Links, Chicago Golf, Cypress Point, LACC, Marion, Muirfield, Pine Valley, Royal County Down, Royal Melbourne. All of those golf courses originally were designed by the greats. They've stood the test of time. Yes, they've had some tweaks to them. But what is it, Gil, that you think made those golf courses that you put on the list? What are the similarities? But what do you think made them so great by the designers? Because if you look at what you all know now about grass, about agronomy, about the ability to be able to move earth and things like that, they were so not like that. And I think there is this big push right now in golf course architecture, wouldn't you agree, that it's to try and move as little earth as possible. And there was a time in the 80s, you know, the Nicklaus stuff was all of these big push Loxahatchee down here in Jupiter, these big giant mounds everywhere. Pete Dye did that at the Players' Championship. All of this earth move, and it seems to me there's this throwback move now to try and move as little earth as possible. And if you look at the golf courses that you listed as some of your favorites, they aren't, they're not golf courses that have a lot of earth moving to them.
You know, you've never seen me swing a golf club, so if you look there, a lot of those are wide golf courses. I'm a big fan of options and width. And I think that a lot of what those courses do is they allow the player to determine the way they're going to play the golf course versus the architect determining it for you. And so I think that's the best set of golf, is that the questions that are asked are compelling for the best players in the world, but they're also compelling for a 30 handicap. And they're also compelling for a 10 handicap. And so that there are options and ways to play. And I think that's a similar, you know, with the exception of Pine Valley. Pine Valley asks questions and you have to, you got to step up and hit a golf shot. Bill Kittleman is the great old pro at Marion who's worked with us on several projects. Just turned 90 the other day. So shout out to Bill. Not that he listens to podcasts, but anyway, he was an amazing mentor to Jim and I, but he, you know, there would be occasional times where we'd put a bunker or something in, or you'd do a force carry, and he would just look at us and say, you know, son, sometimes you just got to hit a golf shot. And that's just part of the test. But I think in by and large, those golf courses occupy great natural sites. The architects maximized the potential of those sites. They gave you options. They asked really interesting questions within the landscape. So I think that's what we look for. I think, as I mentioned earlier, the move to these more remote sites were, and the questions that were asked of McKinsey and Crump is, you know, just build us the best golf course, not build us the best golf course and hide the cart paths because we want to have wall-to-wall cart paths, not build us the best golf course and, oh, by the way, we need a waterfall or we need a lake. Oh, by the way, we need to photograph this. It was solely, purely about golf. And I think that's ultimately what led them to be so great. And that's what the, you know, the Mike Kaisers of the world are looking at. They're just saying, hey, find the best piece of property and build us something that's solely related and predicated on quality of golf. And I think if you look at those 10, and you can quibble whether some belong, some don't, et cetera. And that's one of the great things about what we do, right? We talk about golf. It's why do you like this? Why do you like that? I understand fully the Shinnecock Hills is probably a better quote unquote test of golf than National, but I'd rather play National because it's just more fun. It's more interesting. There's more opportunities to play, but you as an accomplished player, you might be like, no, kidding me, Shinnecock's so much better than me. So there's, and that's the great thing about that. We get to argue the merits based on what we see, and there's no right or wrong.
One of the quotes that I am looking into to talking to you today, I love that you said this, the soul of what you are doing is about the playing of the game, right? Not about all of the other things. You know, Gil, I worked at Austin Golf Club, not Austin Country Club, but I worked at Austin Golf Club for Ben Crenshaw's home course that he did with Bill. And I worked there for a year, and there was a new course that opened up in Austin. This is like 2005, another new course. And somebody said, hey, Ben, have you played that? He said, yeah, I played it the other day. I thought it was great. And some guy said, yeah, it was really, really nice. But I mean, a tour pro would just destroy that golf course. And Ben Crenshaw said, you know, there'll never be a professional golf event at that golf course, right? He said, if you look at all of the golf courses on the planet Earth, it's less than 1% that will ever have a professional golf tournament on there. But everyone that plays golf looks at it, I think, through the lens of the professional, right? So how do you balance all of this out? Because obviously you're trying to balance out building golf courses, doing a restoration, let's say at a place, you know, like Los Angeles Country Club, the members are going to play it. So it has to be playable for them, but it also has to be a test to professional golfers. And I don't think, and you probably are, you're in the same world that I am. I don't think our listeners realize the difference between professional golf, tournament golf, major golf, the caliber of shots, the type of golf you have to play those golfers, and then what the rest of us do who aren't on television, right? There is a massive difference. How do you balance it out between saying, okay, what am I going to try and test here for the players? You know, for a major championship, you know that if you're going into LACC, the US Open's there in 2023. So whatever design work you're going to do to change the golf course to take it back to old pictures, I mean, ultimately the showcase is going to be this coming June when the best players in the world are there. How are you trying to balance that test?
Well, it comes down to, you know, two things. One thing that, you know, what Ben was talking about, which, by the way, Bill and Ben are, you know, they've been so, so good to me and Jim, and they're just the best people, but also the best designers. And so they're incredible. And from that standpoint, you know, but we all work for clients, right? Everybody seems to think, oh, well, Gil Hans thought that was a great idea to do a Hoopy Match Club. Uh-uh. That was Michael Walrath's idea. And he came to us and he said, hey, I've got this crazy idea. I want to build a golf course where you don't ever write your score down. You play. And Jim and I are like, yeah, that's incredible. And so we have to work for what the client's looking for. If the client's goal is to host a major championship, like, you know, we just built the new course in PGA Frisco, which is going to host a senior.
I saw some pictures of that yesterday that first kind of leaked out online. Again, looks very, very minimal, kind of that bunkering that looks like kind of found object bunkering and things like that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, interesting. We found nine holes and we had to construct nine holes. And so I'm hopeful that at the end of the day, you know, Jim and I think if you can't figure out which ones we built and which ones we found, then we've actually done a really good job out there. But you're working for the client, and that ultimately is what you have to build your golf course for. Like if he's saying, hey, I want to challenge all my buddies that are single digits and that's who's going to play out here and that's the reputation we want. Great. If it's, you know what, no, my mom and dad are going to play golf out here with me and I want them to be able to enjoy the test of golf. So there's a lot of that baked into new course design. From a restoration standpoint, it gets back to that whole just trusting the original architect. And then ultimately, as I say, when our hands are off the wheel, when Kerry Haig and John Bodenhammer step on site for setting up major championships, and we have built such a great relationship with both those guys and their teams that we trust that they get it. And they have ultimately goals for what they're, you know, everybody says, well, they must have a target score. No, they don't, because it's all down to the weather that week and the way this setup ultimately works. But George Thomas at LECC was such a genius that he figured out ways that through the setup of the golf course. And that's something that we focus a lot on. We focused in Frisco, we focused in Rio for the Olympics, was that on any given day, if the architecture is good enough, they can set that golf course up as hard as they want or as easy as they want. So if you give options to tuck pins or bury pins where it actually, you know, the interesting conversation, and I'll ask you this question because the guys that you teach, you know, are angles relevant anymore? They hit it so far, so well. Do they really care if they've got a bad angle coming into a green? Do they really care if a pin's tucked up behind a bunker? Do they ever think, you know, do I want to get to this side? And I think a lot of what we see in major championship preparation is that becomes more relevant because the penalties are that much more severe if you don't hit the shot. The rough is thicker, it's harder. You know, it's not like a regular tour setup every week and week out. And so I think ultimately, if the original golf architect has provided enough setup opportunities that, you know, the Wednesday seniors after lunch event at LACC, those guys can go out and have fun. And in June 2023, they can set it up so that it's difficult enough for the best players in the world. And you're spot on. The difference in quality between what they do. I mean, people always say, oh, how are you going to, I'm like, we're not. You know, the golf course is going to be, the weather is going to be what challenges them, whether it's firm. And I think that's, sorry to digress and ramble, but, you know, that's ultimately the best defense. You know, if we have good architecture, we have, if the wind blows and if the golf course is firm, because you work with these guys, and in my mind, I'm thinking you're working with them to have a predictable outcome every time they swing the golf club. When they swing a 7-iron, their outcome's predictable. When they swing the driver, it's predictable. But when the ground is firm and bouncy, they don't, that's not a predictable outcome.
Predict it.
Is it going to bounce twice and stop? Is it not going to stop? Is it going to check? You know, those types of things ultimately add so much to the test, and those are completely out of our hands.
So let's take a short break and we will be back right after this.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Let's get back to the interview.
I think one of the things in major championships, Gil, when we're walking around with players over the 20 years that I've been doing this, I don't think the people that are listening would they'd be blown away what we're talking about. I'd say the majority of the time when we're talking about non-technical stuff on the golf course, from a strategy standpoint at majors, it's all about where you want to miss it, right? Yep. And so there's this fine line between talking about where you want to miss it and where you're trying to hit it. And I remember I worked years ago, Trevor Immelman, who's a good friend of mine, he's been on the podcast. Trevor was too smart for golf, right? His brain was just too smart. He overthought everything. And he would just obsess about outcome, right? And we played a practice round with Tiger when he won at Royal Liverpool, where he just shot zero were super baked out and had that great round where he never hit driver. And we played a practice round with Tiger, and this is like, you know, in the day Tiger mania. Mm-hmm. And watching, I mean, Trevor watched the way Tiger and Steve Williams went around that golf course. And everything was about, okay, that's where we're going to hit the golf ball. That's where we're going to hit the golf ball. And if we miss it, we miss it there. And that was it. It was point A to point B. And if we are going to miss it, the miss is better from here than it is from there. We're either going to lay short of these bunkers or we're going to take it over it. And I think it was interesting to watch a young kid early in his career like that for Trevor. He was like, Tiger just makes golf so easy. And I was like, yeah, because he focuses on where he's trying to hit the golf ball. And then he thinks about where he's going to miss the golf ball if he's going to miss it. And if you think about it, that's a pretty good philosophy. But we are doing a lot of, from a technique standpoint, you know, we are doing a lot of the player is looking out, okay, can we get it over those trees? What's the risk versus the reward? Obviously, Gil, the players I'm working with don't have distance issues, right? There's this massive debate in, you know, in modern golf today, distance. How do you deal with that as an architect? So I'll give you a great example. Marion in 13, the first par three is that par three in the composite.
Right.
And it was a little into the breeze, and DJ was playing with Jeff Ogilvie and Lucas Glover. And DJ hit three wood and came up short, and Lucas and Jeff both hit driver and came up short. And as we're walking up to the green, Jeff Ogilvie looks at us and says, man, what a great hole, huh? We all just missed the green with a driver and a three wood. And I think there is this philosophy for the average golfer that we've got to make golf courses longer and length. But the players don't want that. The best players in the world who are the longest don't want that. They don't want the golf clubs or the golf courses to be longer. They want to be, I think they want to be questioned and forced to hit good shots. And as you know, the Rory McIlroys of the world, the John Rahms, the Justin Thomases, the Dustin Johnson, Cam Smith, they want the golf course as hard as possible. They want hard golf courses. I mean, we've gone so much, Gil, in looking at players. We've looked at stats and gone, okay, your type of golf is predicated on your good ball strike, your this. Again, using Trevor Immelman as an example, Trevor hated going to places like Palm Springs, hated going to places like that. I remember once I was working with him, this is like 2-3 years ago, he was in Palm Springs and he was shooting, you know, he missed the cut. And he's like, I'm going to shoot 100 when I go to Torrey Pines next week. And I'm like, you'll play great at Torrey Pines next week. This is a hard golf course. And he finished top 10. And he was like, I have no idea how I finished top 10 because I go to Palm Springs. I'm like, those golf courses, like you said, they're wide open. They're easy. There's no kind of premium. The best players in the world want their games to shine and be identified. So how do you, from a distance standpoint, deal with that today? Because everybody's saying the golf ball and the players hit it too far.
A lot of it's just the natural constraints of the property. Like if you're dealing with an old golf course, we Jim and I believe strongly that we hate to create what we call a disconnect, where, you know, what most of us love about great old golf courses, you walk off the green and you're pretty much right on the next tee.
Oh yeah.
It's great. If you've got to create something, and you know, Wingfoot was one example where number 12, you know, you walk back 100 yards to a tee that's appropriate for them. I hate that. We didn't create it. It was there, but it was one of those things where we don't want to break up the flow of the round of golf. Those guys are so used to just walking back that it's not like they're noticing the fact that they're walking back. You know, you and I might notice, boy, this is getting tiresome. Not that I'd ever play back there, but you know, this is getting tiresome. So we try to, as best we possibly can, just say, hey, this is the distance that ultimately correlates the best with what Thomas was trying to do, with what Ross was trying to do. And that may wind up being 7,300 yards, and that's fine. You know, and that's long, but it's not long for them. We don't feel there's nothing we can do to physically challenge those guys with length. They can hit it so far. It doesn't really matter if it's 7,700, 7,800. It's just going to be boring to watch that sort of thing. We'd rather have a more compelling and interesting test. And then the other thing you start to think about is, okay, do the math. if we're trying to build, and the best golf courses in the world have the variety of shots. They have a par three like the third at Marion, and then they have a par three like the 13th at Marion that's 120 yards. You can't have a 130-yard par three and a 310-yard par four and do the math and get to 7,800. So you start to sacrifice the variety and the quality of golf holes in order to reach this mythical number. And so we don't ever focus on the yardage. It's not the primary thing. Our primary goal is to create the best, the most compelling and interesting set of 18 golf holes. And on these major championship tests, that's been somebody else's work, and we've stuck to that. We haven't said, by the way, we could get 50 yards here, but it would just totally destroy the way the golf hole was intended to be played. So, Jim and I are not on the sort of beating the bandwagon of, okay, we got to roll the ball back. The smarter people will figure that out. We're just working with what we have. Could be next year that all of a sudden we've got to roll back, and now we've got to think about shortening some golf courses. But I think distance is never the primary focus. We're certain distance, but we also don't think that that's going to be, the be all end all. Now, that being said, we built a golf course in Texas and Frisco that, if you stretch it from back to back, back hole locations, back tees can play like 7,800 yards. But that is really, again, just to provide options for Kerry Hague. He may get a downwind and he may be able to pull a tee back 50 yards that because the wind's blowing howling out of and downwind. And okay, now that makes sense. But it's within the context, again, getting back to set up as architecture for major championships, as many tools as we can give those guys in their toolbox, then they're going to create a better test for the best players in the world. But yeah, distance isn't, it's nothing. It's not something Jim and I dwell on.
One of the things my dad has always said, if you think about all of the great iconic par threes, they're not 210. They're not 190. All of the great, great par threes that provide, from a major championship standpoint, they provide great theater, 12 at Augusta. There's these great holes. I thought you guys did a great job with that little short hole at the Country Club this year, down the hill. All the players, Gil, loved that. They all got there and went, oh, this is really, really cool. Whereas you would think that they wouldn't think a short hole downhill. I mean, guys are hitting pitching wedges and stuff. But, if you miss that green, you're struggling to get it up and down. Why do you think that is, that all these great iconic par threes aren't super, super long, and they tended to be a kind of cool, almost funky design?
I think that, from our perspective, the hardest holes to design are long par threes because they're already hard by their nature because they're long, right? And so you're asking somebody with one shot to hit a green with a wood in their hand, not to hit a fairway, hit a green. And then, so what do you do to make them more difficult? You don't want to put water on them. You don't want to put bunkers all over them. Whereas a lot of the more iconic holes have got sit in the landscape beautifully, and because they've got bunkers around them, because it's 130 or 140 yards, or there's an ocean along the side of the golf hole because, it's all right. It's not that long. So I think it's a combination of all of those things is how do you make long holes interesting? And I've talked to tour players and they look at long par threes and they're like, yeah, I just want to hit the green and get out of here with three and move on. There's never any sort of a feeling of aggression. And architecturally, as I mentioned before, we don't feel like physically we can do anything to challenge those guys with length. And so the focus then goes back to the mental. And a hole like 11 at the Country Club last year, if those guys have a wedge in their hand, they can't help but be aggressive. It's just not in their DNA. Go on, I'm going to try and miss this 15 feet short so I got an uphill putt. No.
Yeah, they're looking at the yardage going, okay, yeah, I'm just going right at this. It's 115 downhill. You're right. No matter where they put the pin, whether they put it front right, front left, back, wherever they put that pin in the tournament, 115 yards.
Right, and we saw that hole had a significant bearing on the championship. I mean, Scottie Scheffler, if he played that hole, if he'd parred it, he probably wins the U.S. Open championship. And so it's one of those things where we understand that there's a certain mentality and aggression that we almost want to give them enough rope that if they take the bait, then we've got them. And I think Pete Dye was so good at that. We think about the angles that he set up And you know that a player will look at a shot and go, okay, what's my cover on the hazard? What's the distance to the hole? And okay, if the cover is this and the distance is that, then they're like, all right, I know I can't be short. But if the cover is on this line is 130, and if you play to the right of that, it's the cover's 120, and if you play to the left of it, it's 140. Now it's like, oh man, if I play the 130 and I pull it just a little bit, now I'm in trouble. So it's those sort of setups where you've got the angles, which ultimately, like I said, Pete was a magician with those things. I know it's interesting. I'll never forget, you know, back when I was younger, we did work at Doral, which was, you know, part of the regular tournament rota. And so the first year that the tournament was there after the renovation, and, you know, players, well, nowadays with social media, you know, they set the stage in the first practice round. If somebody doesn't like something, it gets tweeted, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so there was some chirping. I don't even think maybe Twitter was around, but there was some chirping, some players in interviews. And I was walking, following a group, and your dad was there, and he was walking, and he pulled me aside. And he used colorful language, which I won't use, but he said, he said, don't let these guys get you down. He said, this is a hard golf course. There's nothing wrong with it. And there's nothing wrong with these guys playing a hard golf course.
Yeah, so absolutely.
You did a great job here. So getting back to that, you know, and those golf courses identify the best players. And we had great players win at Doral. It was 3 years after the rest, you know, the renovation of the golf course. So I agree, the great players, they like it hard. They want to play difficult. And, you know, you hear the stories about Jack walking into the locker room and guys grumbling. He's like, okay, I know I got that guy beat. And so it's, there's the great players in this day and age, you know, Rory's, they walk in, Tiger, obviously, in his day, they know, okay, you know, this is like you're saying with Trevor Immelman, you know, when it's a shootout, anybody in the room can win.
Yeah.
When it's a major, then, you know, there's really only 20 guys. Maybe some guy gets really lucky and gets hot that week. And I think that, so we have to remember that when we do work, and we've had a little bit more cover because, you know, it's hard to say Wingfoot's bad because Gil Hanse did anything. It's Tillinghast Golf Course, you know, so it's ultimately, and we love to go into the weeks of major championships saying, hey, focus on Thomas, focus on Tillinghast, et cetera. But when it's our own work, you know, you hear this chirping, and I'll be perfectly honest, you want to get on your soapbox and say, no, that's not what we're trying to do. But then you come across as sounding defensive and shrill. And so it's just like, okay. And as you were saying, the golfing public takes, because he's great at golf, he must know what he's talking about when it comes to architecture. He must know that this is a bad golf hole because he said it's a bad golf hole versus...
It's a bad golf hole because he made double and it's called that he made double.
Okay. Right. I've learned to be more patient with those sorts of things.
Let's take a quick break.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
And we are back.
Whether it's your work or whether it's the course that you've come in and helped change, when there is a major championship there, when you watch players not struggle, but when you watch players hit shots and don't make pars, that get into trouble, as an architect, are you like, okay, that's what we wanted to do, that's we wanted to try and challenge, and it makes you feel good? Do you take, you know, some weird perverse thing, kind of going, ha, we got... I have always wondered that, because, you know, the golf course, when you play golf courses, it's hard to remember the guys that designed them. They're doing it to challenge you. The golf course is supposed to be challenged. I think I read somewhere, I want to say this is correct, Alistair McKenzie, did he do camouflage in the Army? And he did something. Yeah. So it's designed by design. The architect is trying, regardless of your handicap, they're trying to test you. So when you watch a golf course, do you get after the US Open at at the country club, do you and Jim get together, you know, by yourselves and say, hey, we did a good job on this hole because that's the challenge we wanted. We liked that they struggled with this. We liked the fact that he hit it to 20 feet, made par, and somebody else in the group down the stretch made double because 20 feet was a good shot, not to 5 feet.
Yeah, we definitely watch. We're nervous, and for two reasons. The learning curve, like you mentioned, is important to us because we're fortunate now. We're going to be doing this for a while. We've got a crazy lineup of courses that we're involved with that are going to host major championships over the next decade, and so we want to learn and get better at our craft. And so we focus on things from that perspective and see what works and what doesn't. The bigger perspective of how we get nervous is really more the perception of the golf course. And that's mostly through the members' eyes. Because rightly or wrongly, if Justin Thomas shoots 15 under instead of, I don't know, it was 6 or 7 or whatever he won with, somebody's going to say, oh, Southern Hills is too easy. And, you know, that golf course wasn't good enough to host a major championship. But they shoot, Matt Fitzpatrick shoots 5 or 6 under. You know, hey, that was a tough test of golf. That was great. And the members walk away, you know, kind of excited and pumped that their golf course stood up to the best players in the world. And you get a crazy situation like Wingfoot in 20, which was just an odd open because of COVID and the whole thing. You know, Bryson shoots 600. He's the only guy under par in the entire field. Yep. And somebody said to me, you know, well, what was it like giving up the, you know, the record low score for the US Open at Wingfoot? I'm like, that was your takeaway from the whole week, was that one guy.
I heard that there as well. I mean, the way Bryson was playing that week, and, you know, my family has so much history there, and you felt like there were a number of members at Wingfoot that were upset that Bryson came in and was doing the things he's doing, as opposed to going, listen, he's doing something amazing on a really, really hard golf course. Like you said, it's not like, you know, 6 under 1 and lost in a playoff, and then there were 2 guys at 5 and 4 at 4 and 3. I mean, there was one guy.
Yeah. And I think that so everybody gets fixated on the score as being the sort of the arbiter of the quality. And as we've been discussing, that's really got everything to do with setup and weather that week. And that's ultimately what dictates how the score goes. From our standpoint, the most important thing is that we get a great champion. Yeah. You really just want, hopefully, the work that we've done in the golf course to identify a great champion. And so that when people look at who won the major championship on that year in that place, they go, yeah, we're really proud to have Justin Thomas. We're really proud to have Matt Fitzpatrick. We're really proud that there are great players that won these events versus, and no offense to the lesser known players, but you'd really would rather not have that happen. So I think if there's any rooting interest, you might start to think, okay, coming down the stretch, yeah, you know, all right, we'd rather have that guy be the major champion versus that guy. And so I think that's the only, being completely honest, that's really the only rooting interest. We're not sitting there going, boy, we'd love to see them both double the last hole. Because I think, honestly, Jim and I, in our own designs, we like to see positive outcomes win championships. I think it's much more memorable if a guy makes an eagle to win a major championship than, one guy made a bogey, another guy made a double to lose. Yeah, that's not our mindset when it comes to golf and setup.
You mentioned setup of a golf course, that once you get to, once the design happens, you guys come in, you do the renovation, the redesign, the tournament goes on. You mentioned setup. There are so many times that I think sometimes the setup can make the golf course almost unplayable. You know, we were at Marion and it was Sunday, and one of the members was working the driving range, and he said, you know, our course has held up pretty good. They haven't beaten it up. And I'm thinking in my head, you've never played this golf course. You first of all, you can't play the configuration of what it is. But on Sunday at a US Open, nobody is ever going to play a golf course from a setup standpoint that is that baked out, that the greens are that firm, that the rough has gotten that much up. The average golfer couldn't finish that golf course. And I think sometimes, is it not frustrating, but as you said, golf is an outdoor sport. They look like they're going to get weather. They're trying to stay away from that. Is there sometimes not so much frustration, but you look at it and go, oh, I wish we could have kept the golf course set up this way as opposed to it being set up that way.
Yeah, it's usually on the easier side, right? It's usually, and we had nothing to do with this. And you know, back earlier, I had a small career in television, and we'd do the U.S. Open when Fox had the coverage. And Wednesday at Oakmont in 2016, that was the best condition golf course I think I've ever seen in my life.
It was unbelievable.
It was incredible. It was impeccable.
So good.
And then you get 2.5-3 inches of rain Wednesday night into Thursday morning, and it totally changed everything. And it was like, you know, I can't even imagine the heartache from the superintendent and the staff and all the volunteers and everything.
They had it so good. It was playing bouncy. It was playing firm. You had guys from the fairway and the rough thinking, okay, maybe I can chip this out and get this just. I mean, DJ on the first hole, I remember his first hole of the tournament, he hit it into the left rough at Oakmont. And I'd already seen a bunch of guys try and go for that green, catch the flyer out of the rough, bounce it over, go down that little hump. And I'll never forget, DJ laid it out, front edge, chipped it up, putted it up, made par. And afterwards, AJ said, dude, I didn't even know who my brother was on the first hole. Normally, we're going right at that pin. We're making double or triple. And he had learned that, but the way that course was set up, like you said, on Thursday, can be so different than the way it is by the time it gets to Sunday.
Yeah, and I guess the best way to is you want the setup. We do. Other people may, the priorities may be reversed. Is we want the setup to flatter the architecture, is to show off every aspect of the architecture that's available to the setup guys, different hole locations. You know, you don't want it to be so firm and so baked out that we can't use that hole location because it's just over the edge. You don't want it to be so soft that they're starting to say, oh man, we've got to go 2.5 paces from the edge instead of 3. You know, and you're starting to go the opposite direction. You really just, you know, the thing that most people don't realize, and I've been fortunate enough to be involved in all these conversations and just, you know, fly on the wall, is how much thought and preparation goes into, like, you know, their setup visits start 18 months before a championship. And then they're coming in, they're constantly refining and tweaking. And so for people to think that, oh, they just made that random decision to put a hole location there today and it didn't work out. No, they've been thinking about that hole location for over a year. And so if the setup flatters the architecture and the architecture flatters the setup and allows them to use everything, that's the sweet spot. That's exactly where you want it to be. I think we look at it as we don't want it to go so far to the easy side and the conditions because of Mother Nature. That's worse than going, although you don't want it to get gimmicky, you know, where it goes so far the hard side that, you know, the best players in the world are, you know, I don't want to beat it up, but, you know, there's like 7 at Shinnecock back in 2004, I think it was. But guys, mm-hmm. I mean, the best players in the world can't hit a green with a mid iron. And it's like, there's something wrong there. That's not right either. So you just hope, and I know that John Bodenheimer, Kerry Hig and their teams, they don't want to be part of the story. They want to get through the week and not have anybody have any blowups or any issues. So it's a combination of the preparation, hopefully certainly the talents of the superintendent. But the wild card is always Mother Nature. That's what it comes down to.
As an architect, we've talked, there does seem to be a trend towards taking golf courses back to the way they used to look, that style. And the agronomy, I think, is changing. There's been this, in my opinion, this augustification of golf courses where there can't be any brown, everything's got to be green. And as a result, Gil, you have to put so much water on the golf course to have it have this aesthetic look so it looks like Augusta. And no disrespect to what they do at Augusta National, but a lot of times when you're out at that golf course, it looks somewhat, not the only term I could come up with, parts of it look like it's fake, that it's so overdone, right? It's so over manicured. There's these great photos that I come across every now and again of my grandfather when he won there in 1948. He hit it in the water on 13. And the water on 13 looks like a ravine you'd find in West, you know, in Texas. There's grass and there's all this stuff. None of it looks ultra, ultra pristine. And I think that it's been cool. I mean, we went 2 years ago and they went back to this year, Congaree on the PGA Tour. where they went and played. What a cool golf course. Wasn't necessarily perfect green everywhere. It had a little brown to it. It had what you talked about, to where you walked from the green to the tee, but it mm-hmm. it had some natural parts to it. And as a designer, how do you judge that? Because again, if the client wants it to look like Augusta and look super, super green and super, super perfect, that's really a different design than someone saying, hey, just go find the golf holes.
Yeah, I think that comes down to client selection, right? I mean, we're and you know, I realize how fortunate we are in that we have the ability to say no. And so if somebody comes and says, hey, we want Augusta, we want a perfect, et cetera, we've got to really think long and hard of it if that's something that we want to do. Because I agree with you 100%. We're much more in the line of natural presentation, firm, fast. I got to spend a year in Great Britain and part of a scholarship from Cornell. And that's really what all of my principles and focus came from, that and the natural presentation of golf courses, as well as the natural design of golf courses. Augusta National does what they do. They do it better than anybody else. It's the most anticipated tournament of the year. We all look to it. But I think if you gave truth serum to every superintendent in the country, they hate it, because they look at that and the members come in the next day and like, oh, did you see it? Oh, man, it was great. The greens are 14. Look at that. It was beautiful.
And yeah, there's no, perfect. Look at that little brown spot on the range. Can you get rid of that? Because they don't have that at Augusta.
Yeah. And so it's very frustrating for superintendents, because nobody has very few people have the resources to do that and make sure that they can keep it and maintain it. But it is, and you're right, that's the evolution of Augusta. Augusta has evolved into that. It is so iconic. As I said, it's so anticipated. There's no way they could ever change that. I mean, they just can't go back to the weedy banks and the grasses and the McKenzie bunkers with all the rough hewn edges, et cetera, et cetera. That's sailed, and maybe for the better, because, you know, we all love it. It's not like people turn off the tournament and go, boy, that golf course is maintained too well. I don't want to look at that, those white sand bunkers.
It's amazing. Lastly, Gil, in 2022, from a design standpoint, what role do you think that the designers designing golf courses today have to play in trying to grow the game? We've built a 9-hole, my dad and Kelly Gibson here, we built a 9-hole par 3 course, where I think the longest hole is probably 120 yards. It's 9 holes. It's changed the club, Gil. Guys play the main course and then they get done, they have lunch and they load up on, you know, booze and get the music going and go play, you know, 90 yard, 80 yard shots. From an instruction standpoint, Gil, getting people on golf courses, they're not good enough to go play. Even if you take them to the ladies' tees, Gil, they're not good enough to play the golf courses. Do you think, I know it's not cost effective, but do you think we're going to see more maybe 9-hole, 3-hole, 12-hole golf courses that aren't necessarily super, super hard, that are user-friendly, to help try and grow the game?
Yeah, we built a golf course in a little 9-holer in Pinehurst, the Cradle.
Oh, it's unreal.
And so just, good. It has, you know, and Bob Debman and Tom Pashley, you know, they took a chance to make fun the front door for the clubhouse at Pinehurst, and, you know, with the giant putting green and then the Cradle. And I get more pleasure out of watching people just tooling around out there with their grandkids, or parents sitting in the Adirondacks watching their kids play, or eightsomes of, you know, knuckleheads playing barefoot and drinking beers, and just somehow that just clicked, and the magic of it and that sort of excitement of getting people, the introductory level to the game is based on fun versus frustration. You got plenty of time to get frustrated with this game. Have fun, get to it in a fun manner. And I think that that's incredibly important. We've got, you know, people, I do Instagram occasionally and you get, yeah, I've stopped because, like, I don't really need that in my life. But, you know, whenever we put up pictures of these great private clubs that we've done, et cetera, they're like, oh, great. You know, I'm never going to get to play there. Thanks for putting that up. And it's like, that's all we do. But we probably, our most anticipated golf course is going to open sometime next year, is the park in West Palm Beach. It's a municipal golf course.
Because we fly over that when we land into PBI. If you're coming in off the ocean, it's over there on the left. If you're taking off, it's over there on the right. And that looks very much like when you fly over it, it looks like when you fly over Seminole. It just looks like a bunch of sand. And it really does have that same kind of look.
Yeah, so it's uber wide, very playable, interesting. But then again, it's just that there's enough there that, you know, somebody who's beginning in the game could just bunt it, get up on the green. You know, you've got to think a little bit. But then somebody like you would get out there and be like, okay, I'm going to attack this pin, that pin. You can really, it's that whole setup. And then with the sandy areas, and they're all kind of, you're not going to lose a golf ball. There's no water. There's no water on the golf course. It's super friendly. You know, just go out and play golf and not get frustrated with it. And so we're almost, well, no, we're as excited about the opening of that, because it's going to show, hopefully, from in our opinion, that great architecture, modestly speaking, great maintenance, playability, wide corridors, et cetera, can actually happen and transfer to municipal golf course where anybody and everybody can go out there for a reasonable price and play that. So I think we'd love to be in a position to help to grow the game. We've done that wherever we possibly can, doing pro bono stuff with first tees and municipal golf courses. Hopefully, not only are we doing something that'll make the game more playable and enjoyable, but that somewhere in some person who's just coming to the game, they'll start to think, I wonder why I like that hole. I wonder why I don't like that hole. I wonder why this is there and that. And then I think, you know, as I'm sure you know, it's when you start to get to a level where you appreciate architecture and you start to appreciate thought, that opens up such another element of the game versus just trying to get the ball airborne and survive. When you get to a place where you can actually start to think about, okay, there are questions that are being asked out here, then I think the entirety of the game and then the entire beauty of the game really becomes apparent to players.
Well, I really appreciate you talking to me. I could talk to you forever. I didn't even get to my favorite golf course is Les Bourdes in France. And I know you guys have done the second course there.
Yeah.
I love that place. That's, to me, that is a magical, magical place.
Agreed.
I've yet to see the new redesign at LA Country Club where the US Open is going to be this year, but I'm super excited. And if it's anything like the rest of the work that you guys do, it's going to be amazing. If there's somebody better that in golf and our design than what you guys are doing, I don't know who it is, because you guys are doing, you know, some amazing, amazing work. So hats off to you guys. And thanks for talking to us. And we'll look forward to seeing you at another major. I mean, you're like Tiger Woods at this point. You're just walking around and all the other golf course architects are looking at you going, man, another major. And you're just going, yeah, another major. Yep, another major.
It's funny because people say, are you going to go? And I go, yeah, I usually go sort of Tuesday through Saturday maybe and then leave. And they're like, you don't stay for the end. I was like, no, if they're talking about the golf course on the weekend, then something probably went wrong. So we cover all our bases. Once those guys show up, that's what the focus should be. You know, it's on them. And so we talk about the golf course going into the tournament. But after that, we let them play it and see how it goes. Well, thanks. I really enjoyed it. It was a great time. Happy holidays.
Great to talk to you. And we'll hope to see you soon.
So that was Gil Hance. Really, really cool interview. And hopefully something that I want to try and get more on the pod is golf course architects, because they're the ones that are designing the golf courses that all of us are trying to play. And I think anytime you can kind of listen to what they're talking about and how they're doing things, I actually think it can help you, to be honest with you, play better golf. So I want to thank Gil for doing that. Wanted to mention on a sad note, the passing of Barry Lane. For those of you that don't know, Barry was a stalwart on the European tour. He died New Year's Eve, 62 years old, and he was a friend. When I worked on the European tour in the early part of the 2000s, you know, I worked with Barry for a number of years. He was a five-time winner in the European tour. He was a big part of their Ryder Cup teams in the late 80s and the early 90s, and was just one of the coolest people I've met, and he will be missed. I think the outpouring of condolences and the emotions that a lot of kind of the old school guys on the European tour, from Ian Woosnam to Thomas Bjorn and stuff, you know, Barry, he played the European tour for over two decades, never lost his card, and was playing on the European Tour Champions, their Champions Tour, but you know, my condolences go out to his wife, Camilla, and, you know, I'll always look back fondly on the times that I got to spend with Barry. He was just an unbelievable ball striker. He was kind of one of the first of the old school guys. He played from a very, very shut position, like we see a lot of the modern players He hit the golf ball miles. He had a lot of speed. He wasn't a very big guy, but I think anybody that got to watch him hit golf balls was just beyond impressed. And he was a gentleman, and he will definitely be missed. And really, really sad to hear about his passing. But want to thank everybody for all the listens for last year. It's a new year. We're going to try and continue to get good guests. Hit me up on social and let me know the kind of guests that you want. Do you want, more guests from the PGA Tour? Do you want more guests from LIV? Do you want more guests from outside the golf space? Let me know, and I will do my best to get them on. But rate, review, subscribe to wherever you get your podcast. Son of a Butch comes to you every Wednesday. We will see you next week.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only, must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.